Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Bijou Banter. We're in a very unique location. We are not in the KUOI studio due to interviews and also some situations regarding the soundboard, but we are recording in the SVP office in the IMU for this episode of Bijou Banter. And joining me is Daniel McGregor-Hoyer.
What's up? How you doing?
And two guests. We have Jacqueline Wall.
Hi.
And Dylan Mass.
Hi.
As well as myself, Matthew Ha. And today on Bijou Banter, we are going to be talking about two very different movies. The first one being Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which is the latest A24 film, opening today at Film Scene at the Chauncey in downtown Iowa City, as well as the Netflix comedy The Bubble, written and directed by Judd Apatow. And we're going to start off with Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which was directed by Daniels, best known for their feature-length film Swiss Army Man, as well as work on music videos like the infamous Turn Down for What musical from music video from 2014. And it stars Michelle Yeoh, Ki-Hoo Kwan, Stephanie Zhu, Jenny Slate, Harry Shum Jr., James Hong, and Jamie Lee Curtis, and the plot of Everything, Everywhere, All at Once from IMDb. An aging Chinese immigrant is swept up in an insane adventure where she alone can save the world by exploring other universes, connecting with the lives she could have led. What do we think of this crazy movie?
Well, yeah, you just summarized it there. It is crazy. I remember just coming into the theater last night, and it's kind of nice, you know, at the beginning we got to see the composers, because they're actually in town for the Mission Creek Festival here in Iowa City, and kind of talking about how the movie is just different in numerous ways. Like, it's, each scene is just so vastly insane, and just complete. It is like a multiverse. It is a multiverse type movie. So Doctor Strange has a lot to live up to, and I was very intrigued. It was very off-putting at first because, you know, there are times it's like it's so quick and so fast-paced where you're trying to get a grasp on what is going on here. But I think once you get that grasp, you are able to get yourself in a pretty good situation with, like, what's going on and how the film is, and it's very entertaining, and I would have to say I really, really enjoyed it.
Yes, I guess to piggyback on that, it was absolutely amazing experience to see it in the theater last night. Like Daniel said, Son Lux was there, who's the composer, they're the coolest people ever. I was with a friend, and we were just like, oh my gosh, they're so cool. Like, we were kind of fangirling over them a little bit. It was just a wonderful experience. It was a wonderful movie. I adored every minute of it. I think the best advice that we got before the movie was don't go to the bathroom, because you will come back and you'll be like, what happened? And there's no way of explaining what happened. But yeah, it was a wonderful movie. I really enjoyed it.
So I guess without going in too much into depth yet about like what I like about the film, I do want to say that the theater experience is, I think that elevated the film a lot. Just having a ton of people be there, everyone was super happy and laughing, and the person sitting next to me was crying, and I was crying too, and it was just such a wonderful time. I also loved like how Film Scene like took time out of their day to do like cute little things like the seasoning, like they did with Dune 2, but this one had like little googly eyes, and I loved it. And I don't know. And so the film itself, just absolutely wonderful. And
yeah, I have to agree with everyone. This is truly a special film. Like, there is literally no other film like Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And to describe it would honestly be a bit of a disservice, because in a way, much like great films like Parasite or Titan, it's a film that is best experienced going in completely cold. Because even by the trailers, which do an amazing job of showcasing just the incredible weirdness of this movie, while also not really telling you what it's all about, what its themes are about, and also how you're supposed to feel emotionally. And just going into it, and by the time you leave the theater, you are literally not the same person, because it, at times, it is overkill. There are so many moments that are just so strange and so absurd that you have to think, who in their right mind would even come up with something like this? Like, how did this get approved? Of course, A24 is the only studio working today that would even approve such a ambitious and audacious script. But what's even more impressive is the fact that everything is not only coherent, but it just works tremendously well on every single way that movie should do. It's like, it has great characters. It's written fantastically. It is hysterical, too. Like, this is probably the hardest and most I've laughed at a movie in I don't even know how long, just because it's so energetic and so chaotic at times. But really what's fascinating about taking this concept of a multiverse movie, which Marvel has established in No Way Home and the upcoming, and as well as in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness coming up in the next month, I feel that this movie is more about the characters and the family dynamics, and the multiverse elements is more, it's a major portion of the plot, obviously. It's the whole driving force of all these characters, but if anything, it's more of a, it's more thematic and it's more metaphorical for the characters in terms of their struggling family dynamics, as well as just even the intergenerational trauma too. And I think it handles everything really, like, it's so strange to describe, but in a way it's almost like this is like the Daniels magnum opus, even though they've only made two films and they're probably going to make more films, but it's hard to top something like this. I really loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just ingenious. I think the whole idea of just kind of shifting between different multiverses, and also, like, you know, having this whole overarching plot about family and kind of like that generational trauma that you were talking about, really helps this film, like, be above, like, other films that try to do something like the multiverse. Because multiverse has not been, it's not a new idea. It's been done to death. Not just in film, but TV has done it for years. And it's honestly interesting how they implemented it into the film, where it still feels like a very coherent story, despite the fact that you got all this craziness going on. And it's just like, it's funny. It kind of grabs all of your emotions and just chucks it against the wall. And it's kind of like how Parasite was. Like, with Parasite, you can't necessarily put in a certain genre. Like, is it a drama? Is it a dark comedy? Is it a thriller? Like, it's really hard to put a film like this in a certain genre. Because, indeed, it is a movie. It's like, it really embraces the fact that it is on this medium, and also can present these variety of emotions and just entertain you in every aspect. And it's like, it's very touching, but it's very funny. I mean, there's like so many scenes in this movie that I wasn't sure if I should be laughing at or if I should be like dramatically invested. I was just enjoying myself.
And the first half is really where a lot of the action that is seen in the trailer and even just sort of in the poster too, because the poster for this movie, which is excellent, it's this collage of all the, I guess, the variants, I'll just say, of Evelyn, who is our main protagonist, played by Michelle Yeoh, and seeing her go on this journey and just all through these different versions of herself. If anything, it's a really interesting story about self-discovery and existentialism too, but not in a way that feels like nihilistic or even just sort of arrogant too, just because basically she's living this life that is really not desirable. Like, she has a struggling business, her relationship with her husband, her father, and her daughter is incredibly strained too, and she wonders, like, why am I living this life right here? And in her different variants, she's like a hibachi chef and like a kung fu master, a movie star too, but in a way, she does remain content. And it's like, the message of the movie, which I don't want to give away too much either, is just, it was way more heartwarming than I was expecting, just because of all the crazy stuff going along. It could have been really either forced or corny or even unlikable in some way, just because it's like, you empathize with these characters, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like anything felt like it was just shoehorned in, because, like, no, we want the audience to shed a tear. It's just, it feels genuine. Everything felt earned, too.
Yeah, I would say that the script was incredibly coherent, incredibly tight, which I think when you're doing this kind of like interdimensional thing, it can get quite messy, especially when you're kind of leaning into the messiness and kind of the funny moments. But like, having this really deep emotional story kind of like throughout, honing everything in, it was gorgeous. And I remember some like saying that when they got the script, it was like for a 4-5 hour movie, and then you see it's not that anymore. And the way that they probably, the Daniels, took the time to really like hone in on how they're going to use these different scenes, these different dimensional moves to really, again, just go back to that emotional core, I think is very impressive.
To go off of something a little different, I just add something. I think that I think the film is very well edited.
Oh, yeah.
And the sound design, especially in the theater, just, like, really hit. Like, one of my favorite things about film is editing. It's kind of a weird thing. I, like, when I, like, watch a film and it's really all edited, I think I'll like it more. And, like, more than, like, a bunch of other stuff then, maybe. But I thought the film was very well edited. Everything felt, like, impactful, and I loved, like, it, like, adds, like, the quirkiness of the film, too. Like, with the title cards and just, like, how the film is structured and, like, how they incorporate, like, the editing into that. And, I don't know.
I think with the, well, the editing is unlike anything I've ever seen in any other movie. Like, it's literally like an Edgar Wright movie times 1,000. Just because it's so quick and just so methodical, too. But everything just makes sense. Because when you look at something like Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz, I wish Orson was here to talk about this, but it's just, you're watching it, it's like, dude, did he have, like, a metronome next to him when he was editing the film? Because it's so, like, rhythmic. It's like, you could just feel everything being composed, like, perfectly. And there's some shots where there's probably 100 cuts in the span of maybe 30 seconds. Like, it's absolutely wild. And nothing feels disorienting either, too, which is why I found really impressive, just because some of the stuff, it's so quick, and you really do need to pay attention with this movie. Like, if you look away for, like, a few seconds, you might be totally lost, but it still manages to make sense. And I think what keeps it from not being confusing from an audience perspective is the fact that there is the sense of self-awareness, too. Like, when Evelyn first finds out about just how this world works and how they have to, like, I guess, possess the other variants and also going through these different worlds, she now is like, this literally doesn't make any sense. As an audience, that's why I was thinking, too. It's just like, what? Like, this, how does this even work? But then, as soon as she learns to hone her skills and her powers, we too, as the audience, get more used to it and accustomed to it. So, as we follow her on her journey, we also understand more of how this world works, and we buy it, too. And the fact that the film acknowledges that and doesn't play it so straight, it has kind of fun with it, too. That also really helps you buy the insanity and absurdities.
Yeah, I mean, I think, really, there's a lot of movies like this where it's like, you know, the absurdity is just there, and, like, I think when they embrace that absurdity, I think that's when the film becomes a lot of fun, because there's just so many characters that just come into this film, and a lot of them you keep seeing constantly, and it's honestly, like, and you kind of see, like, different variations of each character and just kind of how strange each universe is. And I don't really want to spoil anything, but there's, like, a part in the movie, and I know what, and it's a part that Sullenwax did mention in the Q&A that they don't want to, nobody needs to spoil, but there is a certain musician that does come into the film, and you hear his voice. And it's such an iconic voice at this point. I mean, people, like, once you recognize that voice, it's like, you know who it is. And it's just so absurd, but it has so much fun with it. And I think the Daniels, like, all, like, they didn't drift away from the main story, but they kind of had all these sub-stories in there. They kind of had these interesting dynamics going on, and but they still kept the same overarching narrative there, which is honestly pretty impressive, because there's so much packed into this film, but they're able to, you know, kind of have each of those little subplots their own revolution, and but still having the main plot there and giving that its resolution as well. So it really helps, like, the film become a little bit more dynamic like that, because obviously story-wise it is complicated. But you never lose track of, like, what the main story is. And I think that's, like, something that the Daniels really hit home.
Yeah, and the complications, too. I didn't necessarily find the movie, at least the main plot. I don't know if you guys could disagree or if you have different opinions. I didn't necessarily find it complicated, personally. I found the inciting incident, basically, is that this woman is failing to pay back her taxes with the IRS. That's what starts this whole journey, which is hilarious in and of itself. But when you really dissect it to, like, I guess it's bare, like, a bare-bone structure, it's really more about her coming to terms with her own existence, but also trying to repair her relationship with her family. And I think that's very, very sweet, considering just how interdimensional this story is. Like, when you look at something like, it, going back to, like, Marvel, or, like No Way Home or Loki, movies that are about the multiverse, it's like this grand gargantuan plot where it's like, no, it's life or death, everything's gonna go down, it's all because of some like higher power, which that is also a big part of this movie, but the thematic core is just about, is something that we might have to struggle with or also fix ourselves too. Situations like repairing a relationship or paying back your taxes too. So It makes it oddly relatable, too, despite if there is a multiverse out there, if there is a variant of all of us, who knows what it might be like, but it's interesting to look at it from that angle, even taking out the multiverse stuff.
I think, like, how... I also think that comedy plays really well into the film, and how, like, its themes about, like... I don't know if it's the right word, but existentialism, where it's, like, every, like, little thing can matter... Like, the stupid things in life, like, the comedy and just the little things, all make it, like, worth it. And I think that's so beautiful.
I was going to add, again, just really piggybacking on everything that someone said last night, talking about, because my thing for me is it's not cutting. My favorite thing, or editing, it's the sound, the score, sound design. That's my make or break part of a movie. So getting to hear Sonics was amazing, and the way that they described creating the score in which each of these cuts, each of these moments have their own melodic drive happening in each one, so they're having to, like, make all these different, like, melodies somehow, like, all work together in that warmth, but, like, each of them has to have a distinction that kind of, like, works to help you, again, navigate, like, your sound hearing audio of, like, what's happening, and as you're shifting, that each different cut had its own score in a way, and that was really cool.
On the subject of score, I guess we could probably just divert to this. We've all mentioned it, but Sunlux did the score for the film. During the Q&A, one interesting thing that I wrote down, I forgot which one of them said it, but they said that there was no sacred line between sound and music. And I think that's literally the entire thesis statement for their score, just because there's so... And the soundtrack did get released today, finally, and it is one of the craziest works of music I think I've ever heard in a film. Like, it's a 49-track album that's about as long as the movie itself, which is unheard of. And just... every bit that correlates with not only the themes, but also with what you said, Jack, like the editing too, it just feels so perfect. And the blending of different styles and certain artists too is just like, on paper, it's very random. It's like, how do all of these like connect thematically, stylistically? But in the context of this movie, it's literally the perfect choice, and they could not have gotten a better composer or, like, band to do the score for this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Sunlux really, really did something pretty amazing here. I mean, apparently this is the first, like, piece of music they're actually going to have their first live performance since 2019 at Mission Creek Festival this weekend here in Iowa City. And I know Ben Delgado, Film Scene's programming director, asked a question like, will you perform any of these songs live? And it's like, they said potentially they might sneak it in. Who knows? I mean, I guess I can find out for whoever goes to Mission Creek tonight, if you want to go, if you like to. But I think it's also like, you know, this music really has such a diversity around it. It really embraces what the whole diversity of the film, of like the different worlds, the different universes, the different styles of music. I mean, they managed to get Andre 3000 to play a freaking flute on the soundtrack. I mean, Andre 3000, I mean, I grew up on Outkast. Outkast was like one of my childhood growing up. I mean, I remember Andre 3000 just like having this diverse experimental background. And, you know, obviously he doesn't, I mean, he still raps, but he's never going to release an album. But there was like this thing where a few years ago he actually appeared in a public place playing a wood flute. And I was on social media. It's like, this is what Andre is doing now. But then the directors wanted him to use his flutes, and you know, they put it in the movie, and they also brought in Mitski.
David Byrne,
and the one artist who I won't spoil that they brought into the film as well. And I think they really such a good job with that. Like, it's such a diversity of artists that really collaborated on this score. It's kind of like how Hans Zimmer kind of does things, like when he did Pirates of the Caribbean, because initially he's not credited as the main composer in Pirates of the Caribbean, at least the first one. But it's a variety of composers that came in to do this score, which is honestly pretty amazing, because that's like the best type of collaboration where you can just grab a super mega band of these people and just, like, you know, have them, like, you know, collaborate and bring something that is so unique, especially for this film.
Yeah, much like filmmaking, music is a collaborative art, and seeing all these artists, which, like, admittedly, like, I'm not nearly as familiar with music as you clearly are, Daniel, and I really appreciate, like, the insight you've given, like, not only just for this film, but even just when we have conversations about, like, composers and soundtracks. But it's clear that each one of these artists have very different styles and very different interpretations of how they view music, but seeing them come together and create something so collaborative only added to the film's uniqueness, just because it's not like something like Star Wars, where it's like John Williams basically just did the music and it's an amazing score, but where's that collaboration? It's like, it's one style, but this one combining everything together, similar to the theme of just like the multiverse, is how it's just so many different personalities and just different worlds too. It just feels so unique, and I think that it's the best way to describe the movie, just because it's so out there.
Yeah, I think that is the best description of the score. I think really, and honestly, it's pretty interesting that, you know, because I think whenever you get a band to do a score, there's something about it that just really works. I mean, this is not like the first example of a band doing a score. I mean, you had a Arcade Fire for Her back in 2018. And there's also been situations where Bjork, I think, has also been doing some score music. I think she might actually be having one come up for The Northman, mm-hmm. That new Viking film directed by Robert Eggers. I mean, this, and obviously The Beatles you can kind of consider to be the first, because, I mean, initially, like, Hard Day's Night, every song was composed by The Beatles. And this is not the first example of, like, these type of musicians doing a score. Probably the biggest example is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross from Nine Inch Nails, and doing The Social Network and doing Soul, doing Mank. I mean, they've been doing these type, so this isn't the first time, and I think Soul and Wax really adds in that style that really fits in with the film. Very alternative, very very modern, and just really kind of brings out the emotions of the film pretty well, and I think that's where it really succeeds for the film emotionally, because, you know, obviously music is a very universal concept. I think I never met a person, you know, doesn't have, like, a genre of music they don't like, or a genre of music they do like. I mean, it's kind of hard to find those people that don't have anything that don't like music, because it is such a universal concept, because it is an emotional type of thing that works super well into the art of filmmaking, and I think Soul and Wax really did something that really worked into what the Daniels had for this film.
Yeah, were there any other elements that do you want to mention?
Short round. Yeah, that's right. The name
Ki-Hoo Kwan.
Yeah, Ki-Hoo
Kwan. Or Jonathan Ki Kwan, as he's.
Yeah, Jonathan Ki Kwan. Whom people may know as Short Round or the kid from the Goonies, as is kind of back in the limelight now a bit, because, like, and it's kind of weird because you never real, I, when he came on the screen, it's like, this is like an adult Short Round, guys, like, this is like an adult Short Round, and now after the movie, Matthew told me, like, oh yeah, it is Short Round, it's like, really? But he had a really good performance. I think he really, it's kind of interesting how he went from, like, very quick-witted to very dramatic in so many situations. Like, it's all the actors, like Michelle Yeoh did it, Stephanie Hsu did it. There's a lot of these actors are like switching between different styles and genres, and like they're kind of changing up their acting style, but which is really insane. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis kind of did that as well, and it's like there's so much like this cast is really holding. It's like they're going to switch between these certain styles, like kung fu and rom-com kind of, and or I'm not gonna spoil it, but yeah, they're switching to different type of styles of acting, which is pretty insane, but they managed to kind of, you know, make it interesting, and it really just shows how dynamic their acting skills really are.
Yeah, most definitely. Just good. Sorry. Just every actor is absolutely excellent, just because exactly you said, it showcases their range and talent in a film. Like Michelle Yeoh has been acting for many, many years in so many different styles of movies, ranging from like kung fu movies or like comedies or even doing voice roles too. But seeing her essentially do all that in one movie, and that goes for all the actors, is really something. It's something you don't see very much of, and I think it's really impressive, not only from a performance perspective, but also from a directing perspective, just because you have to direct these actors to act in so many different ways, all which feel completely distinct in terms of their character personalities and also their body language too. And that also correlates to the action sequences as well, which are some of the most uniquely choreographed action scenes I've seen in such a long time, just because it's so frenetic and fast paced and also so strange too. Like, there's, I don't want to give anything away, but the way they utilize, I guess we should say, utilize the environment and certain objects is just very impressive in terms of just how bonkers and off the wall it is at times.
So I don't know how necessarily on topic it is, but it is, has to do with actors. The husband was, I heard, originally supposed to be acted by Jackie Chan, and I thought
really?
It was, yeah.
That's interesting.
And I thought it was very interesting that they chose this person to act instead, and I think that they did a good job with deciding the actors, despite having that original plan.
Yeah, I actually can see Jackie Chan in that role too, because right? Jackie Chan has a lot of range,
mm-hmm.
as an actor. He's also a very good singer as well.
Especially since the film has so much martial arts.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cornucopia of just so many things, and
especially since the martial arts like utilizes the environment a lot,
mm-hmm.
it's like a very interesting choice to step away from Jackie Chan. But I'm glad they did it.
Yeah, I would love to talk about this more, but I also don't want to give anything away. So I think to prevent us from spoiling anything, we should probably wrap this up. So what were our final thoughts on Everything Everywhere All at Once?
It's a really good movie. I think really it's definitely something that I don't think it's going to be a while before we see something like, I mean, obviously Doctor Strange is going to be coming out this year, but I don't think Doctor Strange is going to be as insane as this, because I think they really took advantage of like the whole multiverse concept but didn't have but distract from the overarching narrative. The score was so dynamic, the acting was super dynamic, and visually it was dynamic. Like, they really just tossed everything at the wall and it all stuck, and I'm just super impressed just to see like how this film really worked. And I don't think we're ever going to get a film like this again, and I'm going to give it I think it's going to be a 9 out of 10. I'm pretty happy with it.
I think it's, as we talk, just like seeing the ways in which every formal and structural level this movie is like self-referential to like this idea of dynamicism and collaboration. And it's just gorgeous to see. It's gorgeous to see everyone at their best, truly using all of their skills and having fun in the collaboration. I think you can clearly see on every level the kind of joy that has been put into making this film, and it's a joy to see.
So I actually made a mistake. Jackie Chan was actually supposed to be cast as the lead role, not the husband role.
Oh.
So.
Oh, okay. That changes things too.
Yeah. So, but other than that, I found the film to be very like personal to me, it brought me back to times where I felt like down, and I felt like they portrayed it really well in the film, and I felt like also the theater experience really elevated that film to like the next level, especially since like the vibes were so happy and the film makes everyone happy. I feel like that if you would like to go see the film, I'd recommend seeing it in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my take, and I would give it a 10 out of 10.
Nice. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I think it is a new masterpiece, and it's probably, this is going to be one of those films that is kind of, I'm going to say, I think it is a game-changing film in some ways, just because there's literally nothing else like it. It's completely one of kind. It's completely extraordinary, and I implore you, if you would like to please check this out in theaters, because I think we need more original stories like this. I think we need more ways to explore and sort of break through the boundaries of like what could be done with filmmaking, just because this is living proof that there's still so much more to be explored, even though movies have been around for over 100 years. It's just like, it's almost limitless in a way. There's almost no end, and I think Everything Ever All at Once is just, it's living proof that you can just do literally anything with movies, but also connected with really strong emotional themes and make you really feel something and personally relate to, thought provoking and also just funny too. It's just a blend of everything that for me makes movies so special and is why I love watching movies even to this day. So with that said, it's simply one of a kind, and it opens today at Film Scene at the Chauncey. We all highly recommend checking it out if you'd like to. I'm also going to give it a 10 out of 10. It is quite something, and it's currently my favorite movie of the year. Who knows if that'll be topped, but it'll be very hard to, just because it's so different and so, so special. So we're going to transition from Everything Everywhere All at Once to another film that is not in theaters, but it's on a streaming service known as Netflix, and is called The Bubble. The Bubble was directed and co-written by Judd Apatow, who is best known for his comedies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and more recently The King of Staten Island. And the cast, it has a decent ensemble cast of Karen Gillan, Iris Apatow, Fred Armisen, Maria Bakalova, Daniel Dajvani, Keegan-Michael Key, Leslie Mann, Kate McKinnon, Pedro Pascal, Peter Serafinowski, and Goos Khan. And basically, the plot of this movie, according to IMDb, a group of young actors and actresses, are stuck inside a pandemic bubble at a hotel as a hotel attempts to complete a film. So this is another one of these COVID films, and specifically our co-host Orson Codd, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, he said it was heavily inspired by the ongoing production of the upcoming Jurassic World Dominion, which makes a lot of sense. But before we deep dive into it, what were our initial thoughts?
I did not like it. I'm just straight up. I did not like it. Judd Apatow, I mean, he is a very talented director. I think I like about Judd Apatow is that he can sometimes, like, you know, take main actors and, you know, kind of make it semi-autobiographical in some ways and, you know, have it be inspired by, you know, his life, like kind of what they did with, like, Pete Davidson and King of Staten Island and Adam Sandler and Funny People. Like, he does have a talent for, like, you know, making these lighthearted comedies. This, on the other hand, I felt like it was a very ham-fisted way of just trying to get across issues that were going on with the industry, and it was like the industry during this time, and I feel like it was too little too late for this film to come out. Because I don't think necessarily that these... I'm no longer sympathetic to like these type of films. Like, I mean, COVID, obviously a long time ago, like it was something that was different. I mean, and obviously there were films that were made during the pandemic that, you know, tried to kind of capitalize on that idea that it's a COVID film. I mean, like, you get some, like, say, Inside and Kimmy that can work, but then you get something like this, which doesn't. And I just spent half the time just bored out of my mind. It wasn't funny. It wasn't entertaining. I mean, there were some things that I did like. I mean, I think it's kind of mentioned that Pedro Pascal is in this movie, and I mean, I think he was the only actor that I actually had any intrigue with, because it's like, I don't know, half the time he doesn't look like he doesn't know what he's doing, and I don't know, I had some joy with that, but otherwise it was just a waste of time.
I got 20 minutes in, and I mean, it's April, like, finals are coming up, and I was like, I don't know if I, like, reasonably feel comfortable watching the rest of this movie with, like, the strain on my time, because it was one of those things where I was like, it's fine, but also, like, I have stuff to do.
I've seen the Letterboxd header.
Oh, no.
So it seems like I'm the only one of us who watched the entire thing, and I can confirm that it is a steaming piece of trash. It is truly, truly atrocious. On my Letterboxd review, I watched this a couple of days ago. I made a very bold statement that I think this is the worst movie I've ever had to watch for Bijou Banter, and I stand by it. I really, really do. It's worse than Space Jam 2. And the reason why is because, okay, there's multiple reasons. First of all, the central idea is just bad. I don't think you should be making a movie about a pandemic, considering we are still in the middle of a pandemic. If you want to make this in like 10 years when hopefully COVID-19 is done, then fine. But don't do it now, especially when there's still people suffering. And the fact that this movie, it's about actors who think like, oh, quarantine sucks, and it's like, this is the worst time ever. It's like, you're very privileged, let's be honest. It's not like you're, obviously you're still, we all universally were struggling during the pandemic, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, you're under quarantine, but you're still making a movie, you're still getting paid. So I think that's a very cynical approach, first of all. But two, there's no plot. The jokes are trash. Nothing was funny. This movie's 2 hours long. I don't think it needs to be 2 hours at all. Didn't laugh a single time. I'm not even joking, because it's so devoid of jokes. Because every single one is just relying on the fact that it's like, oh, the pandemic is a terrible time. It's depressing. It's like, oh, what do we do in situations where we have to social distance and wear masks? Like, should we hug? It's like, oh, Zoom buffering times, those suck. It's like, that's the joke. It's just the one joke throughout the entire movie, and it's not funny at all. It gets really, really tiresome. And also, too, there's no plot. There is literally no plot in this movie, and it goes on for 2 hours. If the movie was 70 minutes, maybe it would have been I'd be a bit more forgiving. But this was longer. This is literally 10 minutes shorter than Everything Everywhere All at Once, and nothing gets accomplished. It's a waste of time.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand what the mindset was for this film. And I think because, I mean, obviously, like, yeah, I think there is enough time, you know, kind of, you know, look back and kind of like, oh, remember all this stuff? Remember, like, what happened here? But in the end, it's like, it's not even funny. It, like, doesn't do anything vastly different from what we already experienced through, like, the beginning of the pandemic. And it was just insane that they decided to go this route with this movie. I mean, I think there could be some funny ideas to be had, but I think there's just nothing there that, you know, could really emotionally invest in. I think the main issue is that there really isn't a plot. It really is just these actors, you know, just kind of, you know, living in this mansion and shooting this Jurassic Park knockoff, and it's just not that entertaining. I mean, because, I mean, I can't really blame the actors, because I think some of the act, like I said, Pedro Pascal, I think, just has a really insane role in this film, and half the time I feel like everybody was misdirected. Even like Karen Gillan, who is a really good actress, like, she's been in things that she has done quite well, like Doctor Who and like the Marvel Universe, but it's like, even she is trying to grasp some shots and trying to, you know, get some emotion across. And then Wesley Mann is not funny, and Keegan-Michael Key is just wasted. I mean, half the time you forgot that Keegan-Michael Key was in this movie, and it just drags on. Like, there's nothing going on at all.
I think that's also what makes this movie so terrible. It's like, if this was made by, like, some first-time hack filmmaker, then maybe it would be like, okay, they just didn't care, didn't try. But Judd Apatow is a very talented writer and director. Granted, he said some things that are a bit sus, and also not everything he makes is gold, but he's made funny stuff. The 40-year-old version is, yeah, it's dated, especially by today's standards, but it's funny. The characters are enjoyable, and you want to be around them. Even though The King of Staten Island is unbelievably long and unbelievably padded out, that there was a story, and there were characters that I cared about. The problem in The Bubble is that it's like, first of all, Judd, like, you've written good movies. You've written movies with plots and actually had funny jokes in them, and that's not here. But the cast you got is incredible, and they're all wasted. There's not a single person, I'm stumbling over my words here, it's nothing was funny. Like, there's not. I like Pedro Pascal. I like Karen Gillan. I like who else was in this movie? Leslie Mann. I like Keegan-Michael Key. I don't remember anything about them. I don't like their characters because they're given absolutely nothing to work with. The one actress who I do think was genuinely terrible in this movie was Iris Apatow, who is not. It's not Maude Apatow from Euphoria. She's a much better actress, but Iris Apatow is another one of Judd Apatow's kids, but my lord, she needs to take better acting classes. Like, she is not trying at all. And she plays a TikToker, too, so that's really fun. And it's just really, honestly, that element was not nearly as cringe as I was expecting.
It was bad. That's when I stopped watching. Yeah. I couldn't do it.
Like, there's basically, when they're doing their two-week quarantine, they're just like, oh yeah, like, this is so terrible, and then because Iris Apatow is this TikTok star, she decides to make TikToks, which one of them, they do like a choreographed dance bit.
That's like a full-on minute
like
and a half scene.
TikTok.
Like,
it
why?
but also, too, what drives me crazy is the fact that it was clearly not shot on an iPhone. It was shot on probably an Ariflex camera. It's like, if you want to make this a TikTok, at least shoot it on a phone. Like, you know, like in The Batman when the Riddler is, like, communicating with him. It's like, Bruce Wayne. It's like, you almost got there, Mr. Coulson. They clearly shot on an iPhone, so it looks legit. But in this movie, they shot on regular cameras, so you're taking out that as well. And this is coming from someone that can't stand TikTok. So it's like, if someone likes it, they're like, wait a minute, they didn't shoot that on an iPhone 5 or 10 or whatever they're called. It's just, it's so lazy.
Yeah, and then, like, the celebrity cameos are not even funny either. Like, what, you get John Cena to probably just look for a paycheck and just bring in a...
Dylan's reaction was priceless. Yes,
yeah,
he's in it.
Yeah. John Cena, like, I don't care if I'm going to spoil this movie.
I don't care.
But I think it's like, what, you get John Cena to probably waste his time while he's trying to do Peacemaker 2 and just like, you know, I'm just going to tune in via iPad because it makes sense for the pandemic. And it's just like, I'm sorry, wasn't even a funny cameo. Then
no.
Kate McKinnon is so wasted, they for some reason get him John Lithgow. And
was that John Lithgow?
Yeah, that was John Lithgow.
Okay, that's what I thought, but he wasn't in the credits, so I was very confused.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden you get Daisy Ridley as like this yoga horny AI type thing. And
to give context, basically, Pedro Pascal is also a drug addict, so he takes some LSD or edibles or something,
like
acid or whatever. Yeah. And he's doing these workouts with like this mirror thing, and the AI fitness instructor is Daisy Ridley. I don't know why she's in it, because she hasn't been in a movie since Rise of Skywalker, but it's not funny. It's just weird, and honestly, it was probably just there just to please all the strange Star Wars fans out there.
Star Wars fans.
Well, not like, okay, I'm a Star Wars fan myself, but those that are probably prepubescent are going through some, you know, hormonal changes, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's all the,
you know,
that's
you know
all I'm
going
to talk about, because I don't want to get into it here. I don't even know if I can talk about it on this show, but it's just, it's not funny, it's uncomfortable, and it's very, very cringy, too. And also, by the time, the movie basically is just a series of scenes, is a series of sketches, be like, okay, we got to do the quarantine, then we're filming the movie, too. There's also a lot of talk about like studio negligence and how it's like they feel trapped. Weirdly, this movie parallels Don't Look Up in ways that were way more unexpected in terms of the plot structure, because we never talked about Don't Look Up on the show, and I never want to, but it's basically a political satire about climate change and also the pandemic and government administrations. But that one where it's like you have this authoritative power that's like, okay, we're not gonna do any changes and all that. A lot of that was paralleled here, surprisingly. But even worse, because where Don't Look Up was a satire, this one is meant to be a comedy, but I think it takes itself way too seriously. There's zero self-awareness in this movie. It makes it all the more embarrassing and frustrating.
Yeah, I think it's like, what? When you have Hollywood making a movie about how bad Hollywood is, you know you're gonna be duped. I mean, I think it just really... when independent filmmakers, like, you know, people that don't have, like, you know, the studio heads that they have in Los Angeles do films like that, I mean, there could be ways to make it interesting. Like, L.A. Confidential did it in a way that was interesting. Hail Caesar from the Coen brothers did it in a way that was interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of movies that have always been like this, but this one felt really self-indulgent. And, like, just, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this is how Hollywood treated these people, and it's like, yeah, but you're also part of the Hollywood system here. And so, like, are you actually, like, showing like the actual treatment here, are you? No. Just really just making it seem like that, oh yeah, we relate to you guys, like, yeah, I mean, I relate to these actors, and I relate to these people that, you know, like, one of them was like, oh yeah, I made something that's kind of like a religion, and then, like, but Pedro Pascal is just drugged out for half the film, and it's just like, I don't know what they were thinking with this. I think they wanted to do something that was kind of like Don't Look Up, but I felt like it was a little more hand-fisted. I mean, at least Don't Look Up, like, took advantage of the cast they had, and they were, you know, at least, like, I wouldn't say tried, but at least it was, I would say, much better directed than this. And Apatow is a talented director. I mean, he's come a long way from 40-Year-Old Virgin. But I don't think this was the right script or the right film to do, at least in this time, because I think we're at least at the point where we're not in full lockdown anymore for the pandemic. Hopefully we're not going to be that, and that again, knock on wood. But we're at a point where it's like, we're not in this spot anymore. Because, you know, obviously the pandemic is still out there, and people are still suffering, and hospitals are still a bit overwhelmed by it. But it's just like, we're not at that part of the pandemic anymore. So it really doesn't make sense to have this out. I mean, Kimmy at least made sense in some way, but this didn't.
It just felt like Judd Apatow made this for his family and friends and literally nobody else. It's like, okay, if you wanted to make this for Netflix and it's like you wanted to show people comedy, it's like, oh, it's current. It ties in with what we're going through right now. I think if you want to do that, first of all, you need a story. You need a story for any movie, unless you're doing something like Jackass Forever, where it's just like a bunch of dumb stunts and people getting hurt. You don't need a plot for that for obvious reasons. But for this, you're clearly trying to make a narrative, have a story with a concrete beginning, middle, and end, and also make the characters interesting and likable. I think that if the characters were at least identifiable to some degree, even though they're hotshot money actors, it's just like, I don't connect with any of them. I don't like any of these characters in any way. I don't care if they live or die, honestly. It's just so devoid of any, like, humor and also emotion or empathy that I'm supposed to supposedly have for these individuals. And even then, it just, by the time we get to the climax, too, it just divulges into some, like, crappy action movie, basically. By that point, I was just really checked out. Just, like, I just want it to be over. Because it just goes on and on and on, and because there's no plot, you have no concept of time watching this movie. It just feels like a limitless void.
I don't know, I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's literally, I was like watching this movie before we came in to use SVP as a studio today. It's like, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna write some things down and, like, you know, be productive for the next hour, because right now it's hurting my mental state. And, like, I was literally, like, writing things down and just not even associated with the film. It was just on because there was just nothing going on. It was boring. It was unfunny. It was trying way too hard to appeal to the masses. I just don't understand, like, why they decided to put TikTok in this movie. I mean, I won't, get me wrong, TikTok has, I mean, I warmed up a bit on TikTok. I literally got backhanded when I wrote a paper about it in 2019 saying it's not going to be relevant. Well, I'm a sucker now. But, I mean, at least, like, there's multiple areas to it. They're just taking the cringy part of TikTok and just, like, not making it funny at all. And it's just like, it feels so disposable. It feels so manufactured. It doesn't intrigue me. It was boring. It was 2 hours and 6 minutes. I just could not stand watching it. It was just so boring.
Jacqueline and Dylan, did you have any questions for us?
Any questions?
Yeah, about the movie.
Or my mental state, I could read with them.
No. I mean, like I said, I watched enough. I watched the TikTok part, and it was just, like, it felt old. It felt like an old dad joke that wasn't funny, and also, like, that ingrown of being like, oh, when they start making movies about the pandemic, this is why, because then you get movies like this, and no questions.
If you had to compliment it in any way, how would you do so?
That's a good question.
It ended. I literally can't think of a single good thing about it. As much as I still hate Don't Look Up, I can at least find something that I enjoy. Like, there's one line that Timothée Chalamet has that was genuinely funny. And also, the music is really good in that movie. I don't remember anything about, like I said, the acting, the characters, the story in quotes. The music wasn't memorable. The green screen was surprisingly crap, even though this was obviously meant to be, they're filming like a Jurassic World type movie. So obviously it's meant to look fake and cartoony, kind of like Sharknado. That's not an excuse, because the green screen still looks horrible. And even when they're just on the sets too, it's just everything looks so artificial and manufactured. I don't know how to describe it. Like, when they're on the sound stage, it just looks so bad.
I would say coked up Mandalorian saved it. I think, honestly, Pedro Pascal, I mean, let's face it, it's at a point in his career where it's like, you know, he's big enough, and, you know, the Mandalorian was such a thing that was such a, like, character that resonated with everybody, that, you know, he could do whatever he wants. I mean, I think, honestly, I think he's the only one that really actually looked like he tried anything with this role. He tried at least doing something, although it didn't work, I can at least appreciate it, because, you know, it's Pedro Pascal. He's a very likable actor. Obviously, this wasn't the role for him to be in. But everything else, I think it's just, it's disposable, manufactured, it looks fake, it just doesn't feel genuine, it feels very hand-fisted in ways that make Don't Look Up look like the best picture winner this year.
Yeah, I joked on Letterboxd, like, I apologize to Don't Look Up, because maybe I was a bit too harsh. Maybe that was deserving of a Best Picture nomination, and after watching this...
Yeah, because I felt like, you know, at least, like, I mean, McKay at least tried to make it look competent, and unfortunately, Apatow just couldn't. And I think, you know, Apatow is a talented director. I mean, yeah. He definitely has a very talented family. Rosie Mann's a good actress. Mon Apatow made it big with Euphoria. There's so many things that, you know, Apatow has done right. 40-Year-Old Virgin, yeah, it's a bit dated, but I still like it. I still like Knocked Up. I still like Funny People.
I forgot about this, too. Speaking of cameos, Beck was in it.
Yeah.
So Beck had a cameo, and he basically, for no reason, the movie just kind of goes into like a dance or a music number. It's just like, you really just need to fill up time, Apatow. And I remember Googling while I was watching this, like, why is every Judd Apatow movie 2 hours? Because even the movies of him that I like, I think are too long. So I Googled it, and he said, I want to spend time, something along the lines of like, I want to make sure I flesh out the characters and flesh out the story. It's like, dude, this movie has no characters and story. There's nothing to flesh out. So, in retrospect, this movie should only be, like, 45 minutes long.
Yeah, because even when we're introduced to these characters, we're only just getting these certain aspects of these characters. We're not getting to know them.
No.
We're not, I mean, and when we do get to know them, it's very freaking insane and just, like, so unlikable. Like, Wesley Mann and the, what's the other actor's name?
I don't remember,
but they played this kind of on and off again couple, and they're not funny, and Keegan-Michael Key is not funny, and, like, there's just nothing here that's funny. I mean, at least, like I said, Pascal's the only one that's really trying here, and at least got some laughs out of me, and Fred Armisen's wasted. Like, he should be shooting documentary now, right now. He should not be doing this. And I don't get it. Like, I feel like they should have had, if they wanted to flesh out more time to the characters, take out Beck. Take out John Cena on an iPad. Like, I don't care. Flesh out the characters for me. I mean, it just really, I don't know, it was just so frustrating. I just could not bear this movie.
Yeah, I get it. I think we said it all, so it's like, I guess, I have nothing else to say, so I guess final thoughts on this movie, The Bubble. Wonderful poster, by the way.
Yeah.
It's just a green screen with a, like...
Yeah, it's very emblematic of the entire film. It looks fake.
It's a blank, empty void of nothingness.
Yeah, I mean...
That you fill in with your own imagination.
Hopefully Judd Apatow has something else up his sleeve. That is not this. I think this is the wrong type of film to be releasing during this time. I think we're already past a full lockdown point. And I'm honestly just hoping that, you know, Judd Apatow has something else. I don't want him to make something like this again. I'm already saying it, this is easily his worst film.
By far.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a big fan of This Is 40, but at least This Is 40, at least... It was somewhat relatable. This, I could not relate to anything at all. I just could not get anything connected with the characters or the story. I could not it didn't even work as a satire. It was just painfully unfunny, and I think that's the worst type of comedy. 1 out of 10.
You know, the title of The Bubble makes it sound like a game of, like, Wipeout, you know? Like, so I'm like, and that would have been so much more funny, just have those same actors, but playing, like, Wipeout. And that would be a fun 2 hours to watch.
Yeah. I hated it. I really, really hated it. We've talked about a lot of bad movies on Banter. As bad as stuff like Space Jam 2 was, or even
Vacation Friends,
or Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2022, those at least were either so impressively bad that that was kind of a redeeming factor, or at least had something that gave me a bit of joy. Looking back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, yeah, Orson, you're right. The bus scene was awesome. There was nothing like that in here. This movie has no plot. The characters are unlikable. It's not funny. If a comedy doesn't produce any laughs, you have completely failed. Like, I'm sorry. There's no going back. And please, for the love of God, do not support this. Please don't. It's not worth your time. If you want to kill 2 hours, watch Everything Ever all at Once. Or if any, you know, better yet, watch anything else. Watch, I don't know, just go outside and watch grass grow. That's more entertaining. It's better use of your time. This is terrible, and I don't like it at all. I'm also going to give it a 1 out of 10.
I'm actually going to pull an Anthony Fantano. I'm going to give it a not good out of 10.
Oh, here's a good question. What would you rather rewatch? This or the 94th Annual Academy Awards Ceremony?
I don't know. I think I got more entertaining, maybe out of the former than the latter. But I don't know. One's longer, but at least nobody got slapped.
Yeah, no one got slapped during this one. Yeah.
Do you think they'll make a movie about the awards ceremony? That's going to be Apatow's next movie.
You know, that's not a terrible idea.
Not a terrible idea. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Anyway, that wraps up this unique episode of Bijou Banter, to say the least. Tune in next time, where we're going to be talking about Apollo 10 and a half, at least for one of them. I don't know what the second movie we're going to talk about is, but we'll pair it with something interesting for y'all. But, yeah, until next time, I've been Matthew.
I've been very depressed watching this movie.
I've been Jacqueline.
I'm Dylan.
And we will see you all next time. Bye-bye.